Sorry for the small snafu in the display this morning. Okay. Ooh, it's dark today. Decided to draw it twice, who knows. Okay, I'm going to talk about Cairo graphics this morning. Cairo is a library that we're working on to do two-dimensional graphics. You think, okay, what do you need another graphics library for? Well, the basic problem is that we don't have a device-independent graphics library in Linux. We have the X system, where you can draw lines on the screen, and you can't take that same application and generate a PNG file or a PostScript file or a PDF file, what have you. The other thing is that the existing X libraries have ugly graphics. And we don't like ugly graphics anymore. We like beautiful graphics. And so we wrote this new extension, the render extension, to let us get at beautiful graphics. But the render extension doesn't exactly have graphics. It has trapezoids. So the render extension looks a lot like GL. It's very low level. You can't actually use it for any high-level graphics. And so you end up building stuff on top. And the stuff that we started with, what we started to do is build Cairo as just a layer on top of the render extension to let us get out beautiful graphics there. But then all of our users came back to us, like OpenOffice and GTK Plus and KDE, and they said, you know, another X-specific graphics library is a really dumb idea. How about a library that can also generate PostScript so we can print with it? And so we looked at our API that we come up with and said, oh, this isn't X-specific at all. And why don't we just have a little PostScript output layer, and so we've done that as well. Let's see, I work for Hewlett-Packard, no relation, at the Cambridge Research Laboratory in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is on the east coast of America, and I live on the west coast of America, so I'm comfortably far from my boss. Okay, so here's the outline of the tutorial today. I have plenty of slides. I have no idea what you understand and don't understand about graphics, so if you have questions at any level, please feel free to ask. I've been doing computer graphics for a while, so sometimes I get ahead of myself. When I gave a presentation on some of the work that I was doing to my lab mates at CRL, I had a talk, a very technical talk, and they stopped me in the very beginning and said, we don't understand this term, a spline. It's like, oh, okay. And so I'm very comfortable in resetting the talk to whatever level you want to go at. If you want to go into more depth, that will be fine. If you want to go into less detail, more practical stuff, that'd be fine too. So if you do have questions, please feel free to ask. Let's see, I'm going to talk about why we started writing new library. There's lots. We don't really want another one, but we felt compelled to write more code. I don't know. It's a bad thing, I suppose. Obviously, an important question with any new library like this is, what's its relation with existing projects? How does it work in the overall scheme of computer graphics in the Linux environment? I have a lot of examples about pretty much a big part of the first part of the tutorial is on how do you use Cairo. All the examples here are using the C binding. But all of the examples are easily portable to almost any other binding. We currently have Cairo bindings for C and Haskell and Haskell, excuse me. I don't know why I always think it's got an A in it. Haskell, Java, Python, C++, and C Sharp. I don't recall. I probably blocked it out of my mind. What? Yeah. Sorry, I was on a boat with Randall Schwartz a couple of months ago. We had a little anti-Perl rant that he got kind of upset about. He'd been drinking heavily at the time, I'm sure. Okay. Let's see. I'm going to show you how to draw stuff. In the second half of the tutorial, I've got a pretty big section on how Cairo actually works. And that's some pretty detailed mathematics. One of the interesting things about working in 2D computer graphics is that nobody's done work in this area for a long, long time. And so all of the research papers that we came up with looking at how to draw 2D figures are like 20 years old, which is kind of cool. And nobody's ever implemented any of them in a modern graphics system because 20 years ago they weren't computationally tractable. And now they're trivial. It's like, oh, I can do this algorithm. It only takes, you know, a 600 megahertz machine to draw it quite comfortably fast. Whereas when they were designed, you couldn't do that. And what we learned along the way is that 2D graphics and 3D graphics are completely different from a computational model. And so all the work that people have been doing in 3D graphics for the last 20 years is basically irrelevant because we can do things a lot more nifty stuff in 2D graphics by getting rid of a dimension. It's kind of cool. And then I'll do some wrapping. Yeah, everybody has a cough. There must be something in the air here I'm allergic to. So I do start to whisper. You'll know why. Okay. So what do we start out with? Well, we started out with the obvious why would we do anything different from what exists today? And we decided we really didn't want to do anything substantially different. The main things we wanted were a C binding of an easy-to-use C binding for graphics that we could talk to the render extension and talk to printers. So we adopted the PostScript rendering model, and it's very important to separate the rendering model in PostScript from the language. The language is this horrible reverse Polish notation stack machine, which is very difficult to program in. But the rendering model is very nice. It's got, you know, it's stateful. You could there are very few arguments to all the functions. It's very easy to use. And it seems like it's complete. Every rendering system we've come across can be implemented in PostScript, you know, except for the PostScript compositing stuff, which is fixed in PDF. The other thing that we looked at was how are we going to paint on the screen? With PostScript, it's a very simple painter's model. You draw figures, and they lay on top of one another, and they're completely opaque or completely transparent. It's a very simplistic model. That's not how people have done computer graphics for the last 20 years. Everybody likes to paint translucent stuff because translucency is cool. Fortunately, in 1984, another 20-year-old paper, these two gentlemen, Porter and Duff, came up with a kind of an algebra for image compositing that OpenGL uses and PDF uses and DirectDraw uses and Mac OS X uses. Everybody uses this algebra. So we said, aha, this must be the right one. So we stole that. So, okay, let's see. We stole the PostScript rendering model. We stole the Porter-Duff image compositing. And the requirement that we came to after we'd started designing the library was that we wanted the library to generate identical output, or at least matching output, whereas if it looks good, it is good, on all devices. And that means that we can't use things like the PostScript spline, because they're horribly broken. We can't use things like 4x drawing routines, because they look ugly as sin. And that's okay, because we can do our own stuff, and you know, we have lots of CPU these days. So we can afford to do matching output on all devices. Mostly because our screen is accelerated with the render extension, and we knew that the render extension was the right model. So basically everything else gets to look like the render extension. And then it goes slow or fast depending upon how good it matches that. We wanted a very simple and easy to use language binding. One of the things that we learned over 20 years of using the X Window system was that functions with 50 arguments are very hard for people to understand and very hard for people to remember. And one of the things we like about the PostScript rendering model is it has functions like moveTo that takes two parameters, an X and a Y coordinate. And most of the time I can remember two arguments. Is the X before the Y or the Y before the X? It's not too hard to remember. So we wanted a very elegant, clean language binding. I think that's demonstrated. All the examples you're going to see here on the slides are complete. In other words, the code for the examples fits on a slide text of this size. That gives you an idea the library is not very verbose. And of course, we want it to be operating system independent. That's not because we don't love Linux, but because our customers, which are the application vendors, want to build cross operating system applications. You want to be able to take your OpenOffice OpenOffice source code and compile it for Mac OS X. You want to be able to take your Mozilla code and compile it for Windows. You don't want to have an operating system dependent graphics system. And we actually had to compromise in that at the behest of our users in a couple of areas, and I'll show you where those are. But the nice thing is you can actually run this application, run Cairo on Windows, Mac OS X, and Linux today. So that's a good thing. Oh, and Solaris, whatever those other Unix things are like. We ignore those. They'll go away eventually. What is that? Resistance is futile? Exterminate. Okay, so how do we get started with this glorious Cairo adventure? Well, actually, Cairo was the first thing that my cohort in crime, Carl Wirth, wanted to write. So he wanted to write a simple graphics library to do some mapping software. And so he said, okay, I'll draw some splines with this new render extension. And so he got out the render extension manual, and he said, okay, where are the spline drawing commands? And I said, well, there aren't any. And he said, okay, what kind of graphics do you have? And I said, well, I have this half-assed specification for trapezoids that nobody's implemented yet. And I thought I'd do splines on top of that. So I got Carl Wirth all the way down at the bottom. He started out wanting to draw a map with the existing spline primitives. Oh no, this is open source. He got to go all the way down to the bottom of the stack and implement the trapezoid rendering code. And then he got to implement the Cairo library on top of that. And then he got to implement his mapping software. So I've really leveraged his work quite a bit. Okay, so what is the render extension? The render extension is this little X extension that I wrote that basically takes all of the hard parts of drawing and gets them out of the X server. I've taken the Linux kernel model of anything that I think is hard is not my problem. So I took all of the sophisticated geometry computations and all the transformations and all this crap that is no longer in the X server. The only thing the X server draws is the trapezoid. The XRender extension also does all the image compositing because you have to do that at the lowest level. So you can draw a trapezoid and then you can do all the PorterDuf translucency crap that you want to do inside the server. The reason that I architected it like that is because that's how your hardware works. All that your hardware can do is draw either trapezoids or triangles. And it can do all the image compositing. So from the X perspective, there's no real reason to do anything except those. Because all the X is trying to do is be a hardware abstraction. And all of your hardware does trapezoids and image compositing. So all that X should do is trapezoids and image compositing. Of course, we wanted to do more than that. So Carl and I started working on a library called XR, a render-based drawing library for X. Pretty simple notion. But then all the people that we shopped our library around to said, well, would you be interested in using this in Mozilla? And the Mozilla folks said, sure, if we can print with it. And sure, if it would run on Windows. And sure, if it talked to legacy servers that didn't have the render extension, we'd love to use your library. So we opened up the source code and poured a bunch more crap in. So it does printing and non-render support and non-X support. Okay. And then we said, oh, but wait a minute. Now we have a name issue. Because our name has the evil X letter in it. And everybody knows what that means. It only runs on X. So we had to change the name. And so we came up with the same pun that the Windows folks did. They called their Cairo system XP because the Greek letters X and P look like pi and rho. So we independently came up with the same solution to the problem. Yeah. Great, huh? It's named after a Windows operating system version, really. It has given us the opportunity for some, you know, appropriate Egyptian puns. So you see up here in the corner of the screen, can you see? Yes, you can, actually. It's an amazing projector. You see up here, this is our Cairo logo. This is K, and this is R. And this means kind of an intellectual exercise. So this is the papyrus scroll. So this is an intellectual exercise named Kr. Which is as close as we can get. I asked a friend of mine who's done some Egyptology what we should do, and he said that would be good. And so it's kind of fun, you know, you can do the hieroglyphs, and we've got this cool name. And if you notice, back a couple slides, can I do this? What we discovered was that geometrically, with the right font, Cairo is very symmetrical. And in hieroglyphics, they often would surround things by mirrored images of the hieroglyphs. So you'd have some king's name on one side of a thing, and it would be mirrored on the other side, so it looked very symmetrical. So we're kind of taking advantage of that. So you can see we like to use it in lowercase because the C and the O. It's very, you gotta pick your fonts right. Okay, so that was a good digression. Okay. So we try not to uppercase the C because it doesn't look as pretty. Okay. Okay, another interesting thing about this particular tutorial is that all the graphics are drawn with Cairo, and so they're all images because OpenOffice does not use Cairo yet. I actually had to draw this figure originally before Cairo was quite done enough. I had to draw this with OpenOffice, and it looked like heck. All of these beautiful splines on the right-hand side looked really ugly. But now they're beautiful because they're drawn with Cairo. Okay, I originally wanted to do the classic architecture slide where you've got your lovely little wedding cake and it's got, you know, your library up here and the application up here and how do they interact. And I started drawing lines connecting all the pieces and which pieces interact with which other pieces. And I ended up with this figure. And I know it doesn't really give you a good notion that the system has a lot of abstractions in it because it really doesn't. Cairo doesn't try to hide anything from your application. It's just kind of a helper library. So I expect your application will talk to Cairo to do some rendering stuff. But I also expect your application to talk to the rendering system because I expect it will want to do things that Cairo doesn't support. Like, you know, for PostScript, it's going to have to do things like duplex. So your application is going to have to talk to the rendering system. Obviously, your application has to talk to the output device, where a window system needs to create the window to draw to. Well, okay, so there's no abstraction there either. One of the things that we talked with the application developers about is what do we do about fonts? It's always a hard question. And what I've discovered in my experiments in my design experiences with XFT and XFT2 was that the applications really don't want the operating system font system to be hidden from them. Because anytime you hide the font system from the application and try to provide an abstraction layer, you're dropping information on the floor. And the applications are desperate for any information they can get about the fonts. And the application vendors are willing to figure out how the operating system font system works so that they can get reasonable output. So I said, okay, fine. Well, Cairo's not going to abstract the font system either. Well, obviously, we didn't want to abstract the operating system because the application still has to talk to files and that kind of stuff. So Cairo doesn't hide anything from you. Well, great. Library doesn't hide anything from you. How good is that? Well, okay. It does hide, you know, it basically layers in a nice 2D graphics API so you can draw SVGs. So, no, it's not a real abstraction. Okay, so what are we targeting here? What do we want to be able to draw? Obviously, I want to be able to draw with the XRender extension. That was the original idea. We have a problem with X graphics. They all look like hell. And so we want to be able to take a new library and layer it on top of the render extension to get accelerated 2D graphics using the new model. Bugs, of course, those are actually SVGs drawn with Cairo. What? Okay. So obviously that was the original motivation for the XR library. What we also wanted to do, and one of the lessons I learned with XFT2, was that you can't require an X extension. You have to provide some way of drawing to an ancient X server on your, you know, HP X terminal from 1983. So you've got this ancient piece of crap on your desk, and you're making your office buddy use it because you wouldn't touch it. But you still want to be able to play your games, you know, with him. Okay, so his graphics are going to be butt slow, but yours are going to be fast. But you're going to torture him, but you still want it to work, right? You don't want it to not work. So we have to be able to find some way to draw to core graphics. Well, one of the nice things about the render extension is that it doesn't do anything, right? What does it do? It does trapezoids. Trapezoids are pretty easy to do. Cairo's going to generate all the trapezoids, and either it's going to ship them across the wire to the X server, or it's going to steal the X server code and link it into the Cairo library and draw it in memory. Pretty simple. So that was one of the advantages of the XRender extension design, was it doing things on the client or on the server, you'd always get the same results, and just performance would suck if you did it locally. Life is hard. Buy a new machine. And because I have all this drawing code in my application, I can draw to memory. So all these little images here, these are actually ping files. In Cairo, you just allocate a pile of memory, point Cairo at it, and say, draw to that. And Cairo says, sure, I'll draw to that. And then you call the ping library and say, oh, take this crap in memory and dump it out to disk. Very simple, nice and easy to generate images on disk that look exactly as the same as they do on the screen. We also wanted to be able to draw in other operating system environments. Obviously, for Windows, again, we're going to need some legacy compatibility because old Windows systems don't have decent rendering. The new Windows systems have GDI Plus, I guess is what it's called, which apparently can do most of the render extension. So we're going to be winning on there again for a suitably weak definition of winning. We want to be able to draw on Mac OS X so that Mozilla will run there. And it looks like Mac OS X has fine rendering primitives. So that the applications are mostly portable. Again, if you remember that architecture slide, go back to that and we think, okay, it abstracts some of the rendering stuff. So I can draw splines and lines and I can do a bunch of layout stuff. It doesn't abstract the font system. It doesn't abstract the output system. It's not like GL where you say, create a GL surface and start drawing. Cairo doesn't do that level of abstraction. Cairo has operating system and Windows system output device specific functions. And so you say, create a Cairo object for this Xlib surface, or create a Cairo object for this Windows surface, or create a Cairo object for this PostScript surface. It doesn't have an output abstraction at the level of GL, where you just say, create me a GL surface. Because we wanted to be able to have some output device variance on a particular operating system, so there was no way I wanted to say, create me a printer surface, because I wanted the application to have enough control to know whether it was generating PDF or PostScript or exactly what it was, or a ping file, which is actually the easiest way to print on Linux. The other thing we wanted to be able to do is we wanted to be able to layer Cairo on OpenGL. When we were starting the whole Cairo project, the GL folks said, well, why don't you just use GL instead of Cairo? And it was like, well, because we're writing a 2D library. We're not writing a 3D library. And more importantly, we want to provide abstractions for applications developers that they're comfortable with. And the GL abstractions really kind of suck for 2D graphics. They don't have curves. They have triangles. Lots of triangles. Lots of beautifully lit, textured triangles. With 7 light sources and fog. Maybe you want to do that in Cairo too, and we can, but most of the time, people want to draw bugs on the screen, or text, or maybe a little glider or two, you know, with no fog. So, there was a lot of discussion for a long time about how Cairo and OpenGL kind of work together, and what we finally figured out was that, OpenGL is just another target for Cairo. And so we actually have an OpenGL backend for Cairo now. Cairo can talk to OpenGL. It's happy with that. All of a sudden, the OpenGL guy said, oh, it's like Glue, which is this OpenGL abstraction library for 3D applications. And we said, yeah, it's like Glue. That's right. Yeah, sure. Except we never want to talk to Glue because it has light sources. Depth queuing. We don't have any depths. It's pretty flat out here. We have not yet. We have some interest in doing, probably the Mono folks are interested in doing both DirectX and GDI Plus. Probably GDI Plus as an initial target. It's a better match. That's the intent. The current Windows port right now is draw memory and push bits to the screen. Pretty simple. Actually works surprisingly well because you're using the CPU to draw stuff, and CPUs are scary fast. Okay, so one of the other reasons we wanted to go to OpenGL, and there's more stories about OpenGL I can tell if you like, is that OpenGL is massively accelerated. There's actual competition for GL performance in Linux, whereas with X, nobody cares. It's plenty fast. So one of the advantages, even though GL seems like a massive overkill because it's got transformation matrices and all this kind of crap that we can't use from Cairo, one of the nice things is all that stuff is free because it's all done in your hardware. And so the nice thing about using GL is it's really fast. The GL samples we have right now are like 300 times faster than software. Scary numbers like that. So it's really cool because all of a sudden Cairo is really fast. It's faster than CoreX graphics, because the GL libraries are massively optimized. Really neat. So I can draw all this anti-alias textured shaded crap on my screen really fast now. I can't, but other people can, they assure me. I have a Mach 64 chip. What? Yeah, you bet, we go. 4 steaming megabytes of video memory. Absolutely. Who could ask for anything more? Well, yeah, great. Okay, let's see, where are we going? Okay, so we wanted to target lots of different stuff. And so, yeah, on Mac OS X, we're going to target, what's the drawing? I don't know what the drawing library on Mac OS X is. They got 7 libraries with different names and mystic. What, Quartz? Is that the drawing library or the Windows system? See? Nobody knows. Is Carbon? So what's the API called? Quartz is the API, okay. I thought you said Carbon was the drawing system. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, we just use GL. Okay, so one of the questions we always get, that people have done 3D graphics for years, which is apparently graphics to most people. Oh, you're doing graphics. You must be drawing lit, fogged monsters running around on the screen. Well, no, I'm drawing letters. Well, that's not graphics. That's just text. So 2D graphics is extremely document-centric. As you can see, we have virtual paper up here on the screen, and I'm drawing letters on my paper in a specific point size. So there's lots of text, lots of images and icons, and not a lot of animation. And the other thing is there's not a lot of geometry. And that's an important distinction with 3D. In 3D, everything's about triangles. And in 2D, everything's about the picture of the neighbor's baby and the caption underneath. So it's static, often real-world images, and text, lots of it. And not a lot of geometry, so not a lot of geometrically constructed objects. That's changing a bit as people start using SVG for icons, but even there, the SVG icons, what is the first thing you do? You rasterize them so that they can be easily accelerated instead of drawing the SVG at every time you want to use it. Because you don't do a lot of projective transformation in 2D graphics. Almost everything you do is orthographic. So all the figures appear at the same size and maybe scaled from their original size. And so you, manipulating them as bitmaps actually works very well. 2D graphics, people also oddly want to print what they see on the screen. And as an employee of HP, I find that very useful. So it is very tightly coupled with printing. People want to be able to represent what's on the screen exactly on the printer. And that's one of the things that 3D systems don't do at all. I mean, in 3D graphics, you might do a screen capture and print that. But you're never interested in getting at the full resolution of the printer, and the APIs just don't support it. So one of the requirements, of course, for printing is that fonts and graphics must match exactly. It's not like, oh, you can substitute a font in the printer. It'll be okay. When you're dealing with 2D graphics, that's just not okay. The fonts and the graphics have to look exactly the same. You have to use the same fonts. And the other thing is that 2D graphics don't move very much because we're reading documents. And when you're moving the letters on the screen, your eyes get kind of buggered because the screen refresh rate and then things moving around and you can't read them. So nothing moves in a 2D world. If you look at your 2D screen, is there anything moving? Well, yeah, okay, you got some dancing penguins occasionally, but most of the time the stuff that you're looking at isn't moving in a 2D world. And that means that it's almost insensitive to performance. Nobody really cares how fast 2D graphics goes. Does anybody here have a performance problem with their 2D window system? Do you really? You must have grim machines. There you go. Is it fast enough, the X3? Yeah. So he's got like a 10-year-old machine, and it's fast enough. You know? What? Yeah, and that's completely software. Great. CPU. Go CPUs. I'll show you that. Yeah, I've got that here. Yeah. It's really slow. Yeah. Looks better, this other reverse video. Oh, what's my compositing manager? Not even running the compositing manager. What's life like without a compositing manager? So here's my translucent Xterm. Go Xterm dragging. Yeah. Okay, this is using software that is so broken and slow. It's doing about 3,000 or 4,000 instructions per pixel. Painting every pixel on the screen, and it paints them lovingly. Many instructions. Which is amazing that it's useful at all. I mean, you can type commands in and it runs just fine. It's executing, you know, millions of instructions to update the screen. So 2D performance really is fine. Almost all the time. And if I actually went and fixed that, it would be a lot better. There are some things that could be accelerated. Mostly what you need to be able to accelerate is the image composite. You don't need to be able to accelerate the geometry parts. You need to be able to accelerate those low-level touching the frame buffer stuff, where you're reading from the frame buffer, doing some computation, and writing the frame buffer. And most of the reason you need to accelerate that has nothing to do with the fact that your CPU isn't fast enough, but that your AGP bus is so pathetically bad at reading from the frame buffer that if you ever have to do that, you're losing big time. So the other thing that 2D graphics does is very interesting that doesn't ever happen in the 3D world is you update the screen in little pieces. You draw a letter or you draw a line. In 3D graphics, you render the scene. And so in 3D graphics, you always paint the whole frame. And you just don't do that in 2D graphics. You paint tiny little bits. And so there are some interesting effects of that. A lot of the 3D stuff for hidden surface removal and anti-aliasing assumes that you're rendering the whole scene. And so you can capture a bunch of information about the scene and then draw the scene and then throw that information away because you don't need it anymore. Well, in 2D graphics, you can't do that because you're going to draw a tiny little bit of the scene. The other thing that 2D graphics do is they draw everything off-screen in tiny little pieces and then stitch it together on the screen. So off-screen rendering. And GL has extensions to support off-screen drawing that the DRI doesn't support yet. And so you're basically constructing your desktop from lots of little pieces. And in the GL, in the 3D world, you draw a whole scene, and you copy the whole thing. It's a very different environment. Obviously, 2D applications are orthographic, lots of ups and downs. And basically, that means instead of drawing triangles, I want to draw rectangles. And so what's the union of geometry and rectangles? Well, it's trapezoids. So that's why we use trapezoids. Not very many rotated objects. Again, 2D applications like to print. They like to dump things to image files so you can generate a web page, that kind of stuff. And the application developers are not interested in operating system dependence because it's a steaming amount of code to have to write Mozilla, SVG support of Mozilla, huge piles of code. So they don't want an operating system dependent API. In 3D graphics, lots of geometry, lots of textures. They aren't using them as static images. They're using them to paint geometric objects. So you're painting the flesh tones and the skin and pores on your in your games and that kind of stuff. So you use a lot of textures, but it's not the same, quite the same as using images. And they barely use any text at all because, you know, the flesh tone images, the text is just a distraction. And of course you can't print it. It's not interesting if it's not animated, and print doesn't move. You actually could make little flipbooks, which would be kind of fun. That could be that'd be really good for my company. Lots of flipbooks, yeah. It's kind of funny. I just started HP. The merger had just happened, and these guys came in from the printing group into our lab. And I had this giant letter G on my screen. I was kind of looking at it closely, trying to figure out why it was being misdrawn. And they walked in and they saw this all throughout the lab. They hadn't seen anybody doing any graphics at all. And they walked in and they said, "Wow, do you do text?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm sorry. I do some graphics on the side. It's not really my main research because, after all, I know I'm supposed to be doing something that's more." Oh, text is really cool. So anyway, you can make that G use a little more ink. Yeah, great. So actually, we were thinking of making the default Cairo background be this mottled black that couldn't quite be printed with black ink. So that if you took your Cairo object and printed it on the paper, it would use a lot of black and colored ink all over the page. We thought that might be good. It would kind of look nice. White text and a black background could be the default. We decided not to, though. Okay, let's see, lots of animation, very performance sensitive, which is cool because that means when you use GL, things go wicked fast, whereas when you use X, things go painfully slow. You redraw everything all the time. Okay, so what about using a 3D API for 2D? Why is this kind of a bad idea? The main reason today is that the DRI doesn't support off-screen drawing. I have to draw everything off-screen. Everything you're seeing here is drawn off-screen about 9 times before it appears on the screen. And so we really need off-screen drawing. And so if we're going to get things running in a 3D API, they can't be optional. They basically have to be required. And in fact, on the Macintosh, the DL on the Macintosh provides these three key extensions to GL that they're basically not optional to do 2D graphics. You have P-buffers, off-screen drawing. You have render to texture, which means you can draw into something and then paint that onto the screen with a texture engine. And then you have non-power of two textures, which means you can have like 1024 by 768 texture, which GL doesn't by default support. So you see things from Mac OS 10 where they figured out how to extend GL in minimal ways to make it useful for 2D. And so that was basically what I told the DOI folks. It's like, do it like the Macintosh. They figured out how to make GL do 2D. It's very device dependent in the 3D world. Because you're only rendering to the screen and there's no printing support. And GL really has bad text support. It's grim. Basically, for GL text, it's all in user land. And you create these little textures as glyphs. And you paint them one by one onto the screen. There's no font support. You don't have any automatic placement. You can't get the outlines of the glyphs. There's Zippo for text support. Kind of sucks. So what we're going to do instead of using a native 3D API is build Cairo on top of the 3D API so we can do all this stuff in Cairo. When I wrote this tutorial the first time, the GL backend hadn't been written, and it's nice in the last couple of months that it has been written. So now we actually have an example where it actually does work. The nice thing about using GL is we get Windows system independent accelerated rendering. So we can use GL on Windows, we can use GL on Mac OS, if we want to get a more device-independent render, which is a good idea. Of course, again, we have to have P-buffers and the other changes. Now, why did we pick the PostScript rendering model instead of doing something like GDI or X, where you have these huge stateless environments and you pass every parameter carefully in every function call? What? Yeah, well, the reason we didn't is because everybody always gets confused, and you're constantly digging through this stupid XLib manual to know which order the parameters go in the function call. It really slows you down. You're trying to write something that draws, you know, a spline, you know, a couple lines in a box or something. It's like, now you have to go every function call, you're sitting there paging through the documentation. That's painful to do. So the PostScript graphics model, you don't have to do that because it's stateful. They have two kinds of functions. You have state manipulation functions and drawing functions. And the drawing functions don't change state, and the state manipulation functions don't draw. It's a very simple, nice separation. And you've got this big stack of states. You can push and pop the states. It's really kind of cool. PostScript has paths where you can say, okay, draw a line, add a spline, add some text, and, you know, do all the stuff to construct these complicated paths. So you can, it's you know, kind of a bottom-up model where you can draw these little figures and you can glue them together and glue them together in bigger and bigger things. So it's a nice way of building a graphic system from the ground up. And it means that you can build a very sophisticated graphics model with very simple primitives. And that means that at each level, your abstractions can be have very few parameters and be easy to use. And then once you've constructed this shape, you can do three different things with it. You can stroke it, drawing a line around its boundary. You can fill it, dump paint on the inside. Or you can use it as a clip and clip further operations against it. So you draw a path and you clip against it, you draw another path and clip against it, and you reduce your output region. The clip is not Boolean. In other words, the edges aren't sharp, they're nicely anti-aliased. So you get some actually very nice, you can use it for very nice clipping even on the screen. The other thing that PostScript provides is affine transformation. In the X model, there wasn't any affine transformation in the API, and all the coordinates were pixel coordinates, which really sucked, which meant that you do all these transformations and then truncate them to integer coordinates. And so all of your lines would look like heck because they'd all be snapped to the integer grid. And a paper that Sun did in the mid-80s, like 1989, 1990, demonstrated that even if you aren't doing any aliasing, it's a really good idea to have subpixel coordinates. Because it turns out that your eye can sense the subpixel coordinate from the kind of the dithering of the pattern of the non-anti-aliased line. So even without any aliasing, subpixel coordinates are nice. So being able to have those subpixel coordinates down in the render extension and then provide affine transformation above that gives you a nice coordinate system. Now, the transformations that PostScript provides aren't the same as the ones that GL provides. GL provides a full 3D projected transformation with this giant 4x4 matrix. Very nice. 2D applications, you typically don't typically need the perspective transformations of that. And so PostScript provides just simple affine transformations. And that means you can make things bigger and smaller, you can turn them around, you can move them, and you can shear them. You basically push them so that they tilt over. And that's all it provides. It doesn't do anything more fancy than that. We chose PostScript because it was kind of obvious. Well, everybody else uses it. And stealing is good. The other reason we chose is because the functions take very few arguments. PostScript operations take two or three arguments. And the operations are largely orthogonal, which is, it's kind of like Python in that there's only one way to do each thing. If you want to draw a line, use the line tool. Well, there's two. Okay, you can draw a line, rel line tool. I don't think there's any others, though. So that's really nice. It means that with like 10 or 15 functions under your belt, you can start doing useful drawing. And we'll show some examples of that later on today. And the nice thing is that PostScript is in some sense a complete 2D API. There's no 2D system that we found that we can't implement using this API. SVG, a very relatively complicated graphic system, no problem in Cairo. We implemented SVG relatively straightforward. These bugs are SVG images you can get from the web. And so you just dump these through the SVG to Cairo translator, and Cairo draws them on the screen quite nicely. So that gave us some confidence that we had an API that was complete enough, because we can do all of SVG. Paths are sequences of lines and Bezier splines. I talked to one of the researchers at HP who turned out he practically founded the field of computational geometry in the mid-80s. And we asked him, okay, what kind of splines do we pick? There's a million kind. You look in your. I got this book, like this thick. It's splines. That's all it covers. Chapter after chapter after chapter of, you know, Bezier splines and quadratic splines and these wacko formation I don't know. Lots of different splines. And he said, oh, they're all the same. That's like, what do you mean they're all the same? Well, they're all piecewise. You can do every spline in that book as piecewise cubic Beziers. It's like, oh, okay. So there really is only one kind of spline. Beziers are apparently sufficient. You might want to do quadratic splines, but you can build a quadratic spline piecewise with cubic splines. So it looked like Bezier splines were the nice, were the obvious ones to use. The reason we use a Bezier representation is because it has some nice properties. Beziers, there are 4 points, and the nice thing about a Bezier spline is the convex hull of those 4 points always encloses a spline. So it's easy to do hit detection with Bezier splines. Whereas with some of the other forms, the points are random, basically random, and the spline goes in and out of them, so you can't really do hit detection as easily. So it's a nice format for a lot of 2D operations where you want to do hit detection. They're constructed incrementally as a series of small operations. One of the things that the CoreX did very wrong was have these giant primitives that basically had to encapsulate the entire figure you wanted to draw. And it had a separate one for arcs and a separate one for lines. So you could never draw a line and then also draw a curve in the same figure. You could never get them to join. There was a special hack so that you could draw vertical and horizontal lines and get those to join with arcs. So you could draw a rounded rectangle. But I couldn't draw I couldn't rotate my rounded rectangle. That would be wrong. Whereas with this model, it's really easy to do that. Why didn't we add things like circles and that kind of stuff? Why don't we have any conic sections in it? Well, it turns out you can approximate conic sections with Bezier splines, and computationally, Bezier splines are a hell of a lot easier to draw. And I'll show you how we draw the Bezier splines at the end of the talk. And in fact, most 2D systems draw all your conic sections as four Bezier splines for a circle or an ellipse. They just draw one per quadrant. It's amazing how accurate that is. We actually do the math and figure out how to make the Bezier spline approximation hit the circle to within your tolerance. So sometimes we'll use as many as 8. Yeah. Yes, we have in above that. But that is specified. It says when you draw a circle, we have Cairo arc 2. It's part of PostScript. So we are stealing PostScript again. It's got an arc 2, and PostScript says this will, you know, draw some Bezier splines to make a circle. They don't tell you what it's going to do, and they don't guarantee that it's going to hit the tolerance. And in fact, most PostScript implementations don't hit the tolerance for very big circles with a very small tolerance because they only use 4 splines for the whole circle. Because it's within, you know, a tenth of a pixel for most reasonable size circles. We did a little bit of mathematics. It's some interesting stuff. It turns out that you can have a relatively small table that will tell you, for our coordinate space, how many splines you need to use to draw a whole circle to get within your arbitrary tolerance. So we have a fixed point coordinate space, 16.16. So if you set the tolerance to the smallest possible value, and you draw the biggest possible circle, you can use as many as 16 splines. So it's kind of nice. It's like, wow, splines are really good. Very good approximation to circles. And again, it's one of the things that X said when we were developing X specification was, we want things to be exact and have a precise specification. Well, it turned out that was a really bad idea because precise curves are very difficult to specify. And there's a lot of different shortcuts you can take in drawing curves that get you an almost exact curve for like 1/100th the computational cost. And especially when you start anti-aliasing stuff, an almost exact thing may have errors of 1 alpha value in a pixel. What? Okay. Yeah, so okay. So you can see your bell got me all messed up. I'm having a hard time today. It's okay. The other thing is we have circular, PostScript specifies circular pens. PostScript guys learned after they specified that you can't actually draw with circular pens and have nice things come out. So we have an, our specification says the pen is approximately elliptical, approximately circular, and we specify how it's computed, converted into a polygon. So we take the Bezier, I'll tell you about that later. Never mind. We'll go on. Okay, what happened with text? It turns out that all of our application developers already had all of this OS-specific font code. They knew how to get at the fonts in the operating system. They were desperate for all the information down there, and they said, if you abstract this away from this, we're going to kill you. And we said, well, death is bad. How about we let you get at that API, and we'll just kind of glue some Cairo crap around it, and you can pass the native objects to us. And they said, oh, that sounds good. Then we won't have to kill you. But we still wanted to be able, I still wanted to be able to present the tutorial. And so I kind of needed a toy API so that you guys could see how it worked without having to have some 50 lines of OS-specific code on the screen. So we have a toy API that lets you select fonts in a really, really simplistic way. You get a family, a slant, and a weight style. Yeah, bold or not bold, and slant or not slant. It's a very simplistic toy API. We don't expect real applications to use the toy API. And so what we've been able to do on the mailing list is every time somebody says, but couldn't the toy API also do blah? It's like, no, it can't do that. If you want to do that, use the real API. It's very nice. Good way of escaping complexity. The real API, you hand us a font object from the operating system. You just, whatever the operating system kinds of fonts are, you hand us one of those. It's like, oh, cool, we've already got a font. The hardest part about fonts is finding the damn things. So the toy API doesn't specify how they're found. You just hand it stuff, and it gives you a random font. Let's see. And so there's basically two kinds of glyph selection. You either use Unicode, again, for your toy application, or you hand us glyph indices from the font. Because if you're drawing your Devanagari font, the glyphs don't match your Unicode very exactly. You have to, like, pick the glyphs and lay them out lovingly using all this OpenType crap in your font and putting them up all over the screen in the right spots, placing them carefully. Whereas for those of us who write toy applications, we just want to pass hello world so we can put hello world on the screen. So we have UTF-8 for simple applications, and the complex application, real applications, get to use the nightmare. I don't want to see it. It's Pango. It's very complicated. I'm sure Owen loved doing Pango. Okay. Now, you can either convert your glyphs to paths and fill them or stroke them, or you can just draw them directly. The reason that obviously we could have just done the path stuff, but it turns out that the glyph rasterization code in FreeType for tiny little text on the screen is so much faster than our generic path filling code that it's really useful to get at their optimized code so you can actually print text before tomorrow. So we have, just like PostScript has, I don't remember what it has, some draw string API that just blats a string out of the screen. And it also has text path, char path, I guess is what they call it. So we do that as well, same abstraction. And the reason is strictly for to be able to get at the FreeType rasterizer efficiently and have an easier to use API. Abstractly, it's supposed to be the same, but it isn't quite. Their spline filler does generate slightly different values. But again, we're not trying for exact precision here. We aren't guaranteeing what it's going to look like. We're just going to say it looks the same. It's indistinguishable by eye. Okay, so what other projects are related to this effort? All this work is going on now at freedesktop.org. It didn't start there. Freedesktop.org has all kinds of stuff going on. The render extension is going on there. The open source OpenGL implementation called Mesa and DRI is hosted there. The XFT libraries and font config. Those libraries, Cairo doesn't have anything to do with XFT, but it uses font config on Linux for font selection. The other related projects are all this SVG stuff, because people are interested in SVG. KDE has this SVG rasterizer. Mozilla needs SVG stuff. So we have a little library that sits on top of Cairo that you basically hand it big chunks of SVG and it draws it. Turns out Mozilla can't use that because they want to parse the SVG themselves for some wacky reasons. But whatever. We tried. So we can actually draw SVG. What? Yeah. Mozilla always has to do stuff on their own because. Yep. It's arbitrary. It runs on the NVIDIA just fine. It's a generic OpenGL. You hand me an OpenGL surface, and you ask me to draw to it. So no, it's not Mesa-specific at all. Oh no, we've run it on the NVIDIA. Yeah. Oh yeah, it runs just fine. Okay. What is the render extension? I think I'm gonna. What time has it gotten to be? Okay. Barely enough time. I got way too much material. I think that's a good thing. That way we can skip stuff that's apparently boring. So that you don't fall asleep, and neither do I. Okay, the render extension, this obviously was the root of all of the Cairo work. How do we get beautiful graphics in X? The render extension is an X extension for accelerated graphics based on image compositing. It's got our trapezoids. It has weird text support. And the weird text support is designed so that the X server doesn't have to know anything about text. Kind of a huge idea. And oddly, the render extension accelerates Cairo quite nicely. I know, it's hard to believe. OpenGL, it has hardware accelerated compositing and triangles. It doesn't have any text support. But if it has peat buffers, I can accelerate the hell out of Cairo. So OpenGL is another good target. What is XFT? XFT is kind of, it's a way to get existing applications using prettier text. And it was the first big user of the render extension. All it does is text, and it does text in a way that's very compatible with existing core text uses and existing applications that do everything in pixels, orthographically aligned without any transformations. All that XFT is supposed to do is take your free type library, which rasterizes glyphs, and get them onto your screen. It uses the render extension where available and uses font config. XFT is probably not going to be used by Cairo, because XFT has a user-level API that's very pixel-oriented. And Cairo has all this sub-pixel stuff, so I don't think we're going to be able to use it. But it shouldn't matter, because Cairo is also going to use font config, which is where all the important system configuration stuff goes. One of the mistakes that I made in the branding of all this stuff is when I started working with the Mozilla folks, I started working about XFTifying Mozilla. Well, that's not really important. The important thing about the changes to Mozilla were to bring it into the standard font configuration stuff with font config. And so I kind of misbranded that work in Mozilla, and so I'm having some trouble with the Mozilla folks saying, well, you can switch to Cairo, but that's not XFT. Oh, yes, but it uses font config. What's font config? Well, font config is the important thing. So that was kind of a mistake. Now, what is font config? Font config is font management for Linux. It does not rasterize. It configures your fonts, installation, and selection. Most of you are probably using it these days, actually. And it provides some customization for preferences and localization. It doesn't render anything. And in fact, it doesn't even open the font file for you. It just tells you where the font file is, given a name. It isn't X-specific. OpenOffice uses it for printing now. KDE uses it. Qt uses it for all their font selection on Linux. Cairo is going to use font config on Linux systems. Again, one of the requirements from our application developers was that the font selection and fonts that you used in Cairo match the native fonts and use the native font system. Our original plan was to use font config everywhere. After all, I defined it. It must be perfect for everywhere. But on Windows, when you use font config to select a font, you don't get the same font that you'd get if you used essentially the same parameters and handed it to the Windows font selector. So all of a sudden, your application which uses Cairo to draw some SVG on the screen, has different fonts than the rest of your application, even though you specify the same name. Well, that's bad. So the font selection mechanism is OS specific. It's not output device specific, which means that on Linux, for printing and dumping images to disks and displaying on the screen, all of those use font config. And on a Windows box, you're always going to use the Windows font selection method. So what that means is that your fonts are consistent on every platform, but cross-platform, you get different fonts. So if you take a document on Windows and port it to Linux, you're going to switch your font selection methods, and so you may get different fonts. And it's like, well, that seems bad, but the application vendors assured us that that was much better than having the fonts of Windows be different than the native Windows application. So, fine. This is now their problem, not mine. I could try, and I could get really close, but it would never be perfect. And to some extent, perfect is a requirement, and having it match Windows to Linux is not a requirement.
But in the
right. And so our compromise there was to say, fine, you can build Cairo so that it uses font config on Windows. So it's actually possible to have your cake and eat it too, because the APIs, so there's a font config portion of the Cairo API where you actually name the thing and say, oh, I'm going to open a font config font. Here's a font config pattern, open a font config font. So it's very possible to build Cairo on Windows using font config. So yes, it's possible. It's just not the default. No. Font config, again, doesn't tell you how to load the fonts. It only tells you what their names are and how to name them. So when you use font config on a Windows box, you're going to use all of your local Windows fonts, and font config will locate those Windows font files. And so you're going to get the Windows font file. You're going to get, you know, tahoma.ttf as your font file name. It's not going to use the Windows API. Now that you've got tahoma.ttf, you can hand that font file name to the Windows APIs and render that font. Because naming is very subtle. What happens when you ask for oblique and all you have is italic? Well, in Windows, I don't know what you get. You may get Roman. I don't know how it works. What happens when you ask for demi-bold and you have medium and bold? No, it's completely undocumented. So in a Windows environment, I would actually have to go figure out, basically reverse engineer their font matching. No thanks. Much easier to let the Windows API do what the Windows API does and not try to emulate it. Yep. Right. I don't want to do. Well, I could always make font config on Linux do what it does on Windows. Yeah, no thanks. So there's these two different models. Either you get to match across systems everywhere for a single application, kind of horizontally across systems, or you get to match vertically where all the applications on a single system are the same. And the application vendors that I was talking to said this direction is much more important than this direction. Because you basically can't take Mozilla into a Windows shop unless Mozilla uses the same fonts as IE. They just don't care whether it matches the Linux shop's fonts down the street. What? Right. Right. Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah. Right. Right. Well, the problem is not so much getting the same fonts, is getting the same font matching algorithm. You know, depending upon the parameters you pass to your font, what are you going to get back from the system? Well, the way that X solved this was by having no font matching algorithm. That didn't seem very helpful. So Windows has this font matching algorithm. You hand it a bag of specifications. I want a font that looks like, you know, it's about this size, and it's. You specify all this crap in the structure and hand it to Windows and say, give me a font. And it always gives you a font back, but you have no idea what you've got. Yeah. Yes. Most of the time, one of the things is if you use the font listing systems and pick fonts that are listed, you can be pretty sure you're going to get the right. So, but it's when you've got a document that comes from another system, you're going to do some font substitution. It's going to be different. Yeah. Right. Yes, you can. The problem is that the application, that's the application's job, because the application either has to construct a pattern that's suitable for font config, or it has to construct a pattern that's suitable for Windows. And so what Cairo has done is said, not on my problem. If the application wants to use font config on Windows, it's welcome to. Cairo can support that. Right. Right. And it might be nice if Cairo could actually let you configure some customization parameter to do this. But unfortunately, because I really do have to have completely different objects, if I've selected a font through Windows, Windows doesn't give me the file name that contains the font, so I can use FreeType to rasterize it. Oh no, it gives you a font handle. Well, what do you do with a font handle? You can get bitmaps out of it or outlines, but you can't hand it to FreeType. So once you've chosen your font selection method, you unfortunately, in most systems, have also chosen your font rasterization method. So unfortunately, Cairo can't let you choose fonts one way and masterize another way. Systems don't support it. One of the reasons for that is, you know, intellectual property concerns about fonts. Sometimes the font won't let you see the outline. Not true of Linux, of course, but you know, some other, the PostScript, for instance, actually hides the outlines from you, and fonts can say, oh no, you can't convert that to a path. Right. Or you can't, you know, get the elements of the path back into the system. It's funky. So we need to be able to deal with that and accept the fact that on some systems, you choose a font selection method, you also choose a font rasterization method. It's a pain. Design's always about compromise, right? That was not a pleasant compromise, but it was kind of the reality of the environment. Yeah. Yep. Well, the application can have a runtime switch at two paths. Right. Yeah. The application has to choose, because the application has to hand font config the right object. You have to pass it to the right font config API. There's a font, you know, a Cairo, basically create a Cairo font from a Windows font, and there's a create a Cairo font from a font config pattern. So there's two completely different code paths. Once you've done that, you can use the Cairo APIs for all your drawing. That's all the same. But actually getting the font into the system takes two different Cairo API calls. SVG is another related project to Cairo. SVG 1.1 is a W3C recommendation. It has a lovely XML file format, because we know XML is so neat, it's just not worth even arguing about. Oh, come on. You do everything in XML. I know it. Yeah, I bet you do. Okay. So why do we use XML? Because we like parentheses, I mean angle brackets. Hierarchical structured representation. Oh, look, I can draw that with Cairo pretty easily. SVG also includes animation and gradients. Well, Cairo doesn't do gradients very well yet, but we're trying to figure out how to do them. They're really hard. Animation obviously Cairo itself doesn't do animation, but you can have application do animation. So our little SVG viewer, it's kind of missing those parts right now. So SVG allows pixelization to be very device specific. In fact, SVG allows you to snap pixels around and align them to make things look nice. Cool. I want to see somebody do a sensible implementation of that. Oh, make all those the same width magically. So what projects are related here? LibRSVG is the GNOME 2 SVG library. It's LibArt based. And LibArt is kind of Rafe Levine's nightmare rendering library. It's completely software, so there's no acceleration available. So Carl Wirth took LibRSVG and ripped out the LibArt backend and made it generic with a callback interface, stealing all the code, of course. And he has this nice little abstract rendering interface. So now you can plug in any rendering thing into this library. You could plug another LibArt interface back in, and or you could plug LibSVG Cairo in. And LibSVG Cairo just has Cairo stubs for all the abstract rendering routines in LibSVG. And the nice thing is you can actually just have a little string in your application and a string of SVG commands, and you hand it to LibSVG Cairo, and it draws it on the screen. Very simple. And of course, you can load it from disk. And I've got a sample application that does that. Well, you've seen the little SVG viewer. That's the really trivial one. Not yet. We've been looking at that. That might be nice to do. Yeah. One of the problems is that I don't know. We haven't tried yet. You know. So we're trying to figure out exactly how to do output. Our PostScript output right now, for instance, is jump a giant image to disk, because PostScript isn't sufficient for Cairo, but I think SVG would be. So yes, we'd like to be able to do that. I think we can go both ways. SVG is obviously a really good idea, because when you scale up SVG, it looks nice, and when you don't and you scale up images, they kind of suck. Okay. What time have we got? Okay, why don't we take a few questions here before I dive into the API? Yes? No, that's just a C library. Right. It would be nice to get to be able to do SVG in Python. That'd be great. I think it'd be pretty easy. LibSVG is not rocket science. So, yeah. The GTK will probably replace their existing rendering infrastructure with Cairo. It looks like I'm going to be able to. Somebody's already gotten the Qt stuff using Cairo in the back end. We may see that migrate. I don't know. Qt is a little dicey because it's a commercial library. So I don't know what's going to happen with Qt. Mozilla is going to use it. I don't know if they're going to use it for all the page layout or just SVG. We'll see how, if we can get the performance up to where they can actually do all their page layout with Cairo. That'd be nice. OpenOffice will be using it. Mono will be using it. Mono is actually very interested in it because it provides essentially all the drawing they need for the Windows APIs. So that's going to be good for them. And I don't know who else is using it. Bunches of people. Basically everybody. Yeah, question? It's currently the MIT license, and we're having some discussions on that. We were thinking about LGPLing it for various reasons. We haven't. So the current code is MIT licensed, and we're not going to GPL it. The question is whether we use one of the patent licenses. I don't remember the name of that one. The OSL. Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to go look at that license and see what it looks like. Because we're doing a lot of drawing with a bunch of stuff that may touch patents, I know. I'm going to go look at it. You'd be surprised. Yeah, I know. They don't like it. Yeah, I'll go talk to I'll go talk to Martin. I'm going to look at the license and see what I think, and see if I think it's the right thing to do. And if I think it's the right thing to do, I'll push for it. But no, it's not going to be GPL. So be able to do commercial stuff. Yeah.
Sorry,
It's difficult to say. One of the things is that a lot of images that people use in web pages are natural scenes. You have a lot of natural images in web pages these days. Right, and so if things like Cairo start taking off and SVG starts being possible, we may see more stuff moving to SVG. But right now, SVG is so ill-supported that you just might as well just generate images. The main advantage for SVG is when display resolutions change dramatically from 96 dpi. I mean, effectively, in our world today, you can assume the display is 96 dpi, and it works pretty well everywhere. You know, sometimes a little small, sometimes a little big, but it works pretty well. If we actually start seeing dramatic changes in display resolution where you get to 200 dpi or 300 dpi, then all of a sudden the interest in scalable graphics is going to become much more intense. That would be nice to see. The trouble with SVG is that for a typical image like this, for a rendered page, the smallest representation you can get is a ping file. So in terms of bandwidth, it turns out to be usually more efficient to ship a ping file than to ship SVG compressed, because it's just a more compact representation. And is no, it really isn't. It turns out that for almost any scene, any very complicated scene, and the scenes get more complicated, you actually end up having more than one polygon representing the contents of each pixel. And it turns out, I was doing an interesting research project with some very large images, gigapixel size images, and you know, we were thinking, how do we compress this so we can send it over a network at frame rate? And we looked, and it turns out the most compact representation for the image, these are computer-generated images from basically GL, just the raw pixel images uncompressed was a more compact representation than the geometry. And as images get more complicated on the screen, the pixels are constant. You don't need to increase the amount of data that you send to have a more if the rendering is a lot of gradients and lots of polygons, it doesn't matter. The pixels are always the same. So you can compute what your bandwidth requirements are for a pixel-based image, whereas for a geometrically described image, as the complexity goes up, so does your bandwidth requirements. And that's not good. So I don't know how far we're going to go with vector images. And there's bandwidth concerns and performance concerns, compatibility concerns that are going to push back against that. Yeah? Affect the usage. Yeah, that's a good question. Well, it's as long as we're talking about systems that look a lot like the systems today, then there's not a lot of geometry on the screen, and so the bandwidth concerns aren't all that real. It's not a big deal. Again, I expect to see Cairo used mostly for text, and for text we are using the render extension almost exclusively for all text, so that won't change anything. So what it's going to change is geometry. And today, the way that we do geometry is draw on the client side and push images. And tomorrow, what we're going to be able to do is push the geometry to the accelerated rendering engine on the other side of the wire. So the question is, again, whether the trapezoids are bigger than the image in terms of a limited bandwidth environment. One of the nice things about Cairo is that it can render locally and push an image. So if it turns out that it's more efficient to push images over the wire than to push trapezoids over the wire, we can switch Cairo to that mode. So, right. One of the other little sub projects that I'm working on is taking the Cairo rendering code and the X-Server rendering code and having a shared library so that it's the same code. So the performance locally and the performance in the X-Server is the same because it uses the same code. So then questions about the relative rendering performance of the two sides of the wire. It's a CPU, the relative speed of the CPU, and CPUs are all about the same speed. And then the only other concern is the available bandwidth. So you're going to be able to select your rendering location entirely based upon the available bandwidth. And so sometimes it'd be better to push geometry and sometimes better to push images. What? Sure. I mean, you can, every time you create a Cairo context, you can tell it, well, you should be able to switch. Actually, any surface can either be local or remote. Yeah. Sure. What? Yeah, actually, I see which is faster. Right. And actually, the only thing you need to know is the available bandwidth. And you can compute the available bandwidth from round trip times pretty easily. Yeah. And we have the Cairo API has picking stuff. You can tell it, you know, is this point in this path? So you can, and you basically draw the path, and then you can do picking operations on the constructed path before you. So, which object? You if you wanted to know which object, all we have right now is text is pointed path. So yeah, you'd have to construct each section that you wanted to be able to individually detect. Because the way that we do the pick is much the same way that GL does the pick. We convert it to trapezoids and do point-in trapezoid lots of times. Trapezoids are fortunately sorted, so it's a binary. It's a, you know, logarithmic in the number of trapezoids, but even still. Yep. We haven't yet. We haven't started doing that. Right. Right. Well, and right. 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 And that would be nice to be able to do. I mean, CRTs and LCDs are very different. And one of the nice things about the Cairo API is it doesn't guarantee what the output's going to look like. So we can change the insides of Cairo and make it do different things. For instance, on the one of the things we want to experiment with is subpixel rendering on LCD screens for all the geometry. Obviously, you know, we do it with text. It'd be interesting to see what would happen if we did that with all geometry. So we can do that inside of Cairo without affecting the API. And so we're going to, that's an example. Another example is color matching. The Cairo API, all the colors in the Cairo API are sRGB colors. They're not device-specific colors. They're all sRGB colors. We don't do any color conversion right now because sRGB is pretty much what your monitor does, and there's no color calibration information available anyhow. So when we do get a color calibration system, well, we'll be able to start getting consistent output because Cairo is specified with an sRGB interface. We use floating point numbers for the colors, so you can use negative values for R, G, and B, so you can actually get, you can fill the CIE space, the human color vision space, with sRGB, as long as you allow negative values. So we have, I think we have a pretty good idea of how the color model is going to work. In terms of moving from RGB to CMYK or something, we haven't really thought about it. Again, the interface is all floating point, and it doesn't specify the image formats in for the output device. So it should be possible to take our sRGB API and construct a CMYK backend for it. So that'll be an interesting experiment to try. And that might be useful for PostScript. So it'll be an interesting thing to try. I think the API can handle it. One of the things we've been focusing on for the last year or so is in making the API ready for use and not worrying quite so much about the actual details of the implementation. So for instance, the PostScript backend, all that it does is generate a giant raster inside Cairo and dump it to a PostScript file. Well, do we expect to do that in the future? Well, I hope not. I hope we can actually use the glyphs in PostScript and draw them so we can have a slightly smaller PostScript file and make as much of it as possible device independent. But our focus right now is not in doing that level of optimization. Our focus right now is making it so that the API can be used by applications and getting feedback from the application developers as to how the API is doing for them. Because if we have to change the API, we want to do it now. We don't want to do it a year from now after we have all this back-end code that's dependent upon the API. And when the applications have gone down one path. So we're trying to do all the public-facing work first and not worrying so much about the internals. Other questions, or should we take a break? Looks like we should take a break for a while.